Welcome to Wild Tater Podcast, the permaculture podcast for the penniless. And today we continue our permaculture design course journey. This is my journey through my first permaculture design course. And so we're going to talk about today. Yesterday we talked about my history in what I'm doing. Today we're going to talk about the importance of coming to know and understand your climate. Now, it may take several episodes to really talk in depth about climate, especially as it relates to different individuals and different areas and so forth. But as an example of what we want to do is, I did a climate survey. This is a very basic one. I recommend, after doing this basic one, going on and getting deeper and deeper. But first off, we're going to start with the survey questions that you want to answer for your particular climate. Now, the internet is packed with information. You can find everything you need on the internet as far as answers to all of these climate-related questions. First off, what is your first and last average frost date? Okay, and for me, what that means, the first and last frost date is, you know, at the beginning, starting in January, there's going to come a day where you're going to stop getting frozen days, okay, where it's never going to go below 32 degrees or, you know, 0 degrees Celsius, so forth, where it's just going to stop until the new cold season again. And that is considered your last frost date. You want to know that because in my region, I thought it was June 11th, in digging deeper for this, it is actually June 20th, and sometimes even in extreme cases, as late as June 30th, I believe. So, I mean, you're talking all the way possibly up to right before July that there could be freezing. And then the first frost date is the 11th of September. So, and sometimes going as late as the 20th of September. So, if I am going to plant something that absolutely cannot live through frost, then I need to plant it somewhere around between June 21st and the 11th of September. That's how much of a window I have for the, you know, you should be safe. Don't have to worry about frost. Now, that's not to say that you can't take a chance. You know, if you're planting something that could be cold hardy down to, you know, close to freezing temperatures. But, you know, it's very possible that the beginning of June, for example, the very first of June, you might not have frost before the 10th. There's a pretty good chance of that. But it's, you know, the further away from that date you get, the more risky that becomes. And this is average frost date. So, you know, really, if you really need to be safe, if you're buying a really expensive heirloom tomato or something, and you know, don't want to lose this thing, you may want to wait till the latest possible frost date, or at least the latest average frost date. Anyway, find out what yours is for your climate, okay? Second, the average annual rainfall and annual snowfall as well, depending on where you are. Now, this can get a little bit confusing because precipitation in many on many sites is considered rain and snow and hail and just general mist in the air, humidity, you know, I mean, they get really broad about it. And then others just say, rainfall is this, you know, snowfall is another. Anyway, in my town, it's 15 inches per year. That's what you're looking for, is the annual rainfall as well as snowfall. Now, my snowfall average is 47 inches. What that means is that roughly 75% of my, I think it's closer to 80% of my water for the whole year comes in the form of snow in the winter. And so that's something to keep in mind. That that's something that I would also recommend finding out your cold hardiness date. Now that date, I mean, sorry, not date, your cold hardiness zone, that is in many agricultural circles kind of a benign number. What it's really telling is how cold does it get in the winter and how hot does it get in the summer. And find out what yours is, because that's the most common way that stores label their plants as being, you know, down to cold hardiness 5 or whatever, you know, cold hardy zone 5. So when they're talking about zone 5, zone 4, zone 8, whatever, they're usually talking about that. How cold does it get in the winter? And how hot does it get in the summer? Mostly the cold is what it's referring to. Okay, next you're going to want to find out your record low temperature. Now, this is different than the average temperature that we've talked about. All-time record low temperature. And also take note of what year that was. Okay, in 1971, my town hit negative 27 degrees Fahrenheit. That's pretty dang cold, enough to kill some kinds of apple trees, depending on how established they are, and so forth. So that's pretty seriously cold. But it's been 40, you know, plus years since then. And so it's not likely to happen too often. If you can get your tree established, it'll probably survive negative 27, if it's a really cold hardy tree. If not, it could kill it anyway. You know, just be aware of that. Also, your highest temperature, and you're going to want to look at both the lowest yearly temperature. So how low does it get? That would be basically your cold hardiness question. And also find out your highest temperature and take note of the month and so forth. In my area, 87 degrees is the highest average temperature. Now, we've hit 100 before, 100 degrees Fahrenheit, but it doesn't happen very often. And when we do, it may, you know, stick around for a day or two and then be gone. But the average high temperature is 87 degrees. And then the record, all-time record temperature here is 103. I have a hard time believing that, because I swear it's been hotter than that some of the times that I've been here. And this was in 2002, which means I was not here yet, so, you know, whatever. But good to know. Good to know. That also tells me that anything that can stand temperatures up to 100 degrees Fahrenheit without any problem will probably do just fine. It's the things that can't stand, you know, the negative 10 degrees Fahrenheit that really could be at risk. Oh, and I think I didn't mention the average lowest yearly temperature. And here it's 13 degrees. It's already hit 0 degrees a couple of times this year already for myself. So I don't know if this is just a particularly cold, bitter year or what. But anyway, next in line, you've got interesting climatic data that you come across, okay? In my area, for example, as, you know, just a tidbit that could be useful, as I've mentioned, 75% of our annual precipitation, meaning all of our water, comes from snowfall in the winter. So it, you know, if there was a way to harvest the snow, I mean, have a way to catch it, and store it in the form of water that can be used in the summertime, I mean, we might be able to increase what to the land would seem like, you know, from 15 inches a year up to 30 inches a year, which would be a huge difference. I mean, huge. If you're getting 75% of your water in the winter, and you can save, if you could theoretically save all of that, then I could get it to the point where it was as if I was getting 60 inches of rainfall a year. Now, of course, with pumping water out of the ground, I could fake that anyway, but that depletes the water underground, and you know that can be a problem as well. Okay, let's go on and talk about, as you are, remember, this is a permaculture design that we're going for. It's not just permaculture as a principle, an idea, something to, you know, a perspective. We want to design a property, a landscape, something. And so in my case, I am designing my property, especially focusing on 1 to maybe up to 2 acres for this year. But overall, it will be my 5-acre property. I would like to design it entirely to be food forest, a place where I can raise animals and have gardens and so forth, ponds, you know. And so I need to be able to design it into what I'm going for. So we want to consider what the design project site is. For me, it's very easy because it's my property. And I'm going to do that in determining my property and in starting to analyze my property. I'm going to start by looking at it on a very broad scale. Okay, your continent. Look at your continent and see your property in relationship to your continent. And that seems like a weird idea because you're like, well, I'm not, you know, in New York. Why should I care what New York is doing? Well, if you're looking at it on the scale of the entire continent, you can see where it fits in as a biome, as a bioregion. You know, it's nice to be able to see it in its context. And that's a very large context, admittedly, but it's a good place to start. Your continent, and then get down to the level of your state or, you know, region, whatever it is that you're depending on the size of your country. You know, if you're in Hawaii, get all the way down to the size of your country, whatever. And then, pinpoint your property within that so you can kind of see where it fits in within that context. And this is useful because for myself, I'm in Utah, and Utah has several different bioregions. And you can look on a map of Utah, a satellite view of Utah, and you can see, well, there's the whole mountain range, there's the desert range, and there is, you know, this kind of Arizona-like, you know, Grand Canyon-ish kind of looking area. And then you've got these tight-knit little, you know, green garden-like areas. I mean, just looking at the state, you can see this stuff. You can see where forests are. You can see where mountains are. And seeing your own property in the context of all that can help you in considering, you know, elements of your design. What you're trying to do is build up information that can be put into an analysis of your site. Okay, next you're going to want to see your property in the context of the nearby towns, cities, or villages. So in my case, it's kind of between a couple of towns, and so I'm, you know, encompassing this image, satellite image. Google is great for this. And circling my property within that area. And I can see that even trying to talk to somebody in one of these nearby cities, I'm going to want to know more details about it. If they're saying, oh, you can plant, you know, I don't know, jalapenos without any trouble, and you just stick them in the ground, they'll grow, you know, or whatever. That may be the case where they are, but I can see it may be different where I am. And if I'm thinking of passive water harvesting, for example, it's going to make a difference whether I'm at the top of a hill or at the bottom of a valley. That's going to be hugely different because that will determine how much and what level of water capacity I can deal with, as well as things like flood. if you're at the top of a hill, you may have minor floods in huge rainstorms, but it's not going to, you know, fill your basement 3 feet deep from water that's coming from outside. That's just not likely to happen unless the flood goes high enough to be to the top of your hill. However, if you're at the bottom of the valley, same concern, and that'll be a big concern. And you know, if you're dealing with fire, that's something you're going to want to see in context of your, you know, nearby towns and so forth. All of this is very useful. Then you want to zoom in to your site, your property, your whatever it is that you're going to be working on. And this is what I have done for mine, and with a few notes such as the lowest point on the site and the highest point, with a little mention of the slope there that we're dealing with. If I remember right, it's a 2.1 degree slope across the property, fairly flat, but not completely, certainly not completely flat. It's the kind of thing that someone doing large-scale agriculture would likely flatten it out, because you could do that here. I have no desire to do it because I can make use of that slope anyway, and I also, you know, have circled on my image the area that I want to put the most intense design up front or immediately. And then I've got pictures also of my site itself before, so I have pictures of what it's like before design starts taking place in any active way, and I can see what the general region looks like, what the plants look like, what kind of you know, structure the land itself has, where the bits of hills are, where it slopes, things like that. And getting these pictures before even starting the design or even the analysis, just observing it and having pictures of it, you can have elements to be considering in your analysis of the design that you're going to use to come up with your design. And then I went through the property and just pointed out a few more just factoids that are certainly going to be elements to consider in coming up with the design of your site. I've got the lowest point on the site, the highest point on the site. They're both circled, and so you can kind of get a gist of the contour. If I was taking more time at this, I think I would put in a rough contour of the site, but I didn't. What I do have is, from my own observations, the most common and severe wind direction, most common deer migration route, where they tend to come through at morning or night, depending on the season. And then a little note to how far the mountains are away from my site, simply because that has a bearing on the, you know, even if I'm only going to have a certain slope on my property, if beyond it it's suddenly steeper, that's going to make a difference of how much water runs onto my property. Or if it's flat everywhere except my property, it could be quite dry on my property, and or whatever. So the area around does make a difference. So that's where I am with my design site so far, and also the first level of analysis of the climate of my area. And I would encourage you, if you're kind of following along passively or actively and wanting to get a feel for a permaculture design certification course, these are the first, the previous episode as well as this episode are the first several assignments within the design course. So if you are trying to design your own core, your own site, your own landscape or area, this would be a great way to start. And in the coming episodes, we'll talk a little bit more about climate, because that is, you know, the bigger picture of what we're talking about as far as what kinds of things you'll need to know before designing your site. Basically, we're in the observation aspect of the site, looking at the broad perspective based on what facts existed before we ever stepped onto the site. So, that brings us to the end of this episode of the Wild Tater Podcast, Permaculture for the Penniless, or if you prefer, the Permaculture Podcast for Penniless Poor Paupered People, like myself. And once again, thank you so much for listening.